Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. For those who consider the Trump administration a moral train wreck, it's happening on at least two tracks. One is the serial cover-ups, call them simply failures to disclose, if you prefer, of Trump associates' contacts with Russia while Trump was praising Putin and Putin was hacking Clinton. The serial firings of Sally Yates, Preet Bharara, and James Comey add weight to the suspicion that they're covering something up. No evidence of collusion to subvert the election has surfaced so far. So why all the hiding of meetings and the firings of people investigating those meetings? That's one track. The other track, for those who consider the Trump administration a moral train wreck, is the policy track. This morning, Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced he will reverse Obama-era policy and begin to seek the maximum sentence in all nonviolent drug cases. Make America a great mass incarcerator again. Yesterday, Trump announced a commission to study voter fraud, still apparently trying to manufacture doubt from no evidence about whether Clinton won the popular vote. The result could be more laws aimed at voter suppression. Remember when Trump asked black Americans, what have you got to lose? There's the Trump Care proposal to end protections for pre-existing conditions and opioid addiction treatment while giving a big health care tax cut to the wealthy, among other things. Sometimes the shiny objects in the Russia investigation and Trump's provocative tweets, there were more this morning that we're not even going to mention, drown out the even more important stuff. But when things like the Comey firing actually happen, they have to be addressed. So this hour, we will do both. Trump and Russia, yes, but also the new drug sentencing and voting initiatives, and three areas where Trump may be escalating our military involvement: Afghanistan, Syria, and North Korea. His foreign policy has generally been getting better reviews than his domestic ones, but let's not stumble into a big war while we're obsessing on something Trump said to James Comey at dinner in January, right? But to take Russia first, Trump actually admitted to NBC News yesterday that he did fire Comey as FBI director, at least in part because he didn't like the way Comey was investigating him.
When I decided to just do it, I said to myself, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election.
That was very different from the way Trump's aides, including the vice president, had been spinning it just the day before.
Did the president fire Director Comey to impede the Russia investigation?
Well, as you know very clearly, as has been stated repeatedly and the president has been told, he's not under investigation. And as former Director Clapper of the Department of the Director of National Intelligence said, there is no evidence of collusion. Between our campaign and any Russian officials. That's not what. But let me be clear with you. That was not what this is about.
Between campaign officials and Russian officials.
That's not what this was about.
That's not what this is about. So at very least, Trump is getting ahead of his team and hanging them out there to say things he wants them to say, and then contradicting them when he feels like changing his public rationale. Then there's the spin about Comey. White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders yesterday continued to argue that Comey had lost the support of the FBI's rank and file.
I can speak to my own personal experience. I've heard from countless members of the FBI that are grateful and thankful for the president's decision. And I think that, we may have to agree to disagree. I'm sure that there are some people that are disappointed, but I've certainly heard from a large number of individuals, and that's just myself. And I don't even know that many people in the FBI.
She admitted she doesn't know that many people in the FBI. But the acting head of the FBI, Andrew McCabe, testified before Congress yesterday. It was supposed to be Comey, but Andrew McCabe stepped in and said exactly the opposite.
Director Comey enjoyed broad support within the FBI and still does to this day. We are a large organization. We are 36,500 people across this country, across this globe. We have a diversity of opinions about many things. But I can confidently tell you that the vast majority of FBI employees enjoyed a deep and positive connection to Director Comey.
somebody's not telling the truth. And on the White House contention that firing Comey was not squelching the Russia investigation because the Russia investigation is merely an insignificant part of the FBI's work, again, Acting Director Andrew McCabe under oath.
Well, yesterday, a White House press spokesman said that this is one of the smallest things on the plate of the FBI. Is that an accurate statement? Is this a small investigation in relation to all the other work that you're doing?
Sir, we consider it to be a highly significant investigation.
Now, Trump's long record of saying anything he feels like without evidence gets longer. How long Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and most other Republicans will continue to provide cover for him remains a question. Our first guest today is Rosie Gray, political reporter for The Atlantic. Hi, Rosie. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So it's pretty remarkable that Trump admitted to Lester Holt on NBC that the Russia issue did have something to do with firing the main guy investigating it. Why do you think he reversed course from day one, where Pence and everybody else who was sent out said Russia had nothing to do with it?
Well, I can't see inside the president's mind, so I'm not sure why he decided to say that. But I think, you know, Donald Trump has shown a pattern basically of saying whatever he wants, right? And regardless of whether his surrogates are saying something different, there's never been that much in the way of sort of message discipline, you know, on his team. So I don't think that it really necessarily mattered to him, you know, what Pence had said or what the press secretary had said.
The Times has a story today. It's just based on two anonymous sources, so I don't know. But it says Comey told these two people after he and Trump had dinner in January that Trump asked him for loyalty and Comey would only promise him honesty. Here's a clip about that dinner from the Trump interview with Lester Holt yesterday. Rather than it being about Trump asking Comey for loyalty, Trump's version was this.
Let me ask you about your termination letter to Mr. Comey. You write, I greatly appreciate you informing me on three separate occasions that I am not under investigation. Why did you put that in there?
Because he told me that. I mean, he told me
that. He told you weren't under investigation with regard to the Russia investigation?
I've heard that from others. I think
was it in a phone call? Did you meet face to face?
I had a dinner with him. He wanted to have dinner because he wanted to stay on. We had a very nice dinner at the White House very early on. A dinner was arranged. I think he asked for the dinner. And he wanted to stay on as the FBI head. And I said, I'll consider. We'll see what happens. But we had a very nice dinner. And at that time, he told me, you are not under investigation, which I knew anyway.
So Rosie Gray from The Atlantic, that was one of three times, that dinner, that Trump claims Comey told him he wasn't under investigation, which adds to the extreme weirdness of Trump's statements this week. We know the FBI is investigating the Trump campaign's ties to Russia. Could that be true and him not being investigated be true at the same time?
I mean, the investigation could, you know, sort of touch people in Trump's orbit, but not necessarily Trump himself. I mean, one of the big issues here is, you know, the president asking the FBI director multiple times whether he's under investigation is problematic. I mean, you know, if you believe the New York Times account of that dinner, the fact that, you know, he was asking for Comey's loyalty, asking whether he's under investigation. I mean, Donald Trump doesn't seem to have either understood or cared that the FBI director is supposed to be a politically independent agency director. There's a reason why the FBI director serves normally for 10 years. It's so that they're not loyal to any particular president, any particular party.
What about the ethical or legal status of Trump asking Comey if he's under investigation, or Comey answering if that actually happened? A legal or law enforcement ethical problem for either one of them?
Well, I'm not really a legal expert, but I believe that there could be sort of conflict of interest issues, yes.
What about the next FBI director? This is a huge question. Can Trump appoint someone who will look independent enough to the outside world while offering the loyalty to Trump that Trump seems to demand of his appointees, even an FBI director, in general?
Well, right. I mean, a lot is going to sort of hinge on who he decides to nominate for this position. I mean, I think that'll be one way that the White House could sort of look to, you know, sort of calm down the kind of turmoil that has engulfed Washington over this. If they pick someone like who's a clear Trump loyalist, like Chris Christie or Rudy Giuliani, I mean, I really think that they would have a hard time sort of getting that confirmation through. And in terms of, you know, picking someone who's more independent, you know, there were some names being sort of bandied about yesterday. I think Bloomberg had it that Mike Rogers was up for consideration.
The former House Intelligence Committee chairman.
The admiral.
Oh.
I believe.
Okay.
But the point being, I mean, there are names sort of floating around in the ether, but in terms of his, I mean, I don't know whether he's going to make this same demand for loyalty of the next guy. So.
You quote a source close to the White House, unnamed, who says there's a real risk here that things could spin out of control. What does that person mean?
Well, that this situation is just going to get sort of the self-replicating scandal that we've seen before in Washington, you know, during these sorts of times. I mean, I don't want to make like a direct Watergate comparison, but I mean, I'm not sure that the White House really sort of understood what it was getting itself into, or that Donald Trump really understood what he was getting himself into. And by the way, just I misspoke a second ago. It is a Bloomberg did have it. It was the ex-Congressman Mike Rogers who's up for consideration. So.
Right. Reported in Bloomberg News.
Yes,
could be the next FBI director. By the way, is that filibusterable anymore, or is that just up to the Republicans in the Senate to confirm the next FBI director nominee?
You know, I'm not actually sure about the exact rules on this, so I don't know.
And you quote another source close to the White House saying they think Trump is worried about Michael Flynn. Worried about him in what way?
Well, I think they're worried about whether Flynn might sort of cooperate in this investigation and what he might say. They don't know. I mean, you know, obviously he was fired in sort of a very sort of public and kind of humiliating fashion, and I think that's sort of an X factor here.
What do you make of the Andrew McCabe testimony yesterday? You know, one could, if people are worried about creeping authoritarianism and the end of independence of the FBI, the things that McCabe was saying yesterday could be comforting in the sense that Trump may be able to fire James Comey, but he's not able to fire the FBI.
Well, right, and you know, and it's clear that that these attempts by the White House to sort of retroactively spin this as something that was widely supported within the FBI are not really bearing out. I mean, Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying that, you know, countless rank and file FBI agents have told her that they're happy about it. I mean, that just doesn't really pass the smell test. So I do think that, you know, we're seeing something here where there's an institution that is bumping up against a president who doesn't have respect for that institution, and whether that institution is sort of strong enough to stand up to it. And I think the McCabe testimony sort of indicated that it could be.
Listeners, want to get in on this? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And here's a call about McCabe. Vic on the Upper West Side. Vic, thanks for calling. You're on WNYC.
Yes, according to Rachel Maddow, acting director McCabe, who's now being hailed for supporting Comey, was reported the Justice Department guy who went to the White House in February to reassure the administration that a story in the Times was BS, violating all sorts of ethics and rules.
Vic, thank you. Are you familiar with that, Rosie?
I'm sorry, what's the question exactly?
I remember what I didn't see Rachel Maddow last night. I remember that there was that instance of the Times reporting a story that the White House was very eager to debunk. And I remember a report at the time, I believe, that that Trump asked Comey to publicly debunk a Times story having something to do with the Russia investigation. Do you remember the details, Vic?
Well, it's according to Rachel, actually, it was a few nights ago.
Okay.
McCabe was the person who went as a member of the Justice Department to reassure the administration that the Times article, which later proved to be true, that the Times article was BS. So therefore, the White House was, again, meddling with the Department of Justice, and McCabe was the point guy.
Thanks for your call. Anything to add to that, Rosie, or I'll move on?
Well, I can't really speak to this because I haven't done my own reporting on that specific incident. So
you do report that the idea to fire Comey was clearly not generated by Attorney General Sessions. What makes you say that?
So, I mean, look, Donald Trump said himself to Lester Holt that he was going to fire James Comey regardless of recommendation from the Justice Department. So, which is contradictory to what his people were saying before that, which is that they waited for this recommendation from Sessions and Rosenstein. So basically, I mean, the president has essentially admitted that he had made up his mind to do this before sort of seeking reason, a rationale from Sessions and Rosenstein.
Ari in Midwood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Ari.
Hi, Brian. I was wondering, since Trump did admit now that he fired him because of the Russia investigation, whether or not Trump is even guilty anymore, isn't that just straight up obstruction of justice? He just said he's doing this investigation. I don't like it, so I was going to get rid of him anyway.
Yeah, the clip we played, Trump said to NBC yesterday, when I decided to just do it, fire Comey, I said to myself, this Russia thing with Trump and Trump is a made up story. It's an excuse by the Democrats for having lost an election. So to the caller's point, it almost is an admission of obstruction of justice.
Look, I mean, again, I'm not a lawyer, but, I having sort of read people who are, much more sort of knowledgeable about this. I mean, it does raise questions of whether that could become an issue. Yes.
And what about America's new mystery man, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who has only had that job for a few weeks and writes this letter detailing reasons other than Russia that Comey should be fired? I don't understand what he's all about yet. He was U.S. Attorney in Maryland for more than a decade, first appointed by George W. Bush, retained for the full 8 years by Obama, right in D.C.'s backyard, Maryland, U.S. Attorney, with Democrats having only complimentary things to say about him until now, as far as I can find, and confirmed for this new job 94-6. When Democrats are not generally voting for Trump appointees' confirmations, and then he goes and does this really suspect thing. So who is mystery man Rod Rosenstein anyway?
Well, he's one of those sort of key but mysterious figures in these kinds of scandals. But I mean, basically what happened is that the line from the White House is that they had waited for there to be this new deputy attorney general in place before sort of like getting this review of Comey and then moving ahead with the firing. So they've basically kind of tried to sort of pin it on him and on his recommendation on his arrival in the position. In terms of, his own involvement and whether he sort of knew exactly what was going on, and whether he actually explicitly even called for Comey to be fired, like, some of those things aren't quite so clear. I mean, I believe it was either, I think it was both, it might have been one of the major papers, it might have been the New York Times or the Washington Post, had it that he had complained to the White House and asked them to correct the record, basically, about how this decision was made and his own involvement in it.
Right. I think a Times report, I think, that said that he had threatened to resign on Tuesday night after Comey was fired when the White House started spinning it as Rosenstein gave them this document laying out the reasons that Comey should be fired, and that's the reason that they did it. But he was asked by a reporter, a shouted question, did you threaten to resign over them hanging this on you? And he said no. Which only deepens the mystery.
Right. Yeah. It's very mysterious sort of what's going on with him. And in terms of whether he did, in fact, threaten to resign or not, I don't know. But it's clear that, it seems as though, given Donald Trump's public statements and given the sort of inability of his press shop to figure out like a coherent explanation of how this all happened, it seems like one sort of likely scenario is that they kind of they're sort of using Rosenstein as sort of a rationale, basically.
Rosie Gray, Atlantic Magazine political reporter, stays with us as we begin to shift toward policy now and bring on an additional guest. Also joining us is Michael Waldman. He's president of the Brennan Center for Justice and author of the book, The Fight to Vote, published last year. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be with you in interesting times.
Anything you want to comment on? Remind us, by the way, what you did in the Bill Clinton administration.
Well, I was his director of speechwriting, among other things.
And anything you wanted to comment on from what we've been discussing so far?
Well, gosh, there.
I saw you taking a lot of notes.
I was taking notes, and it is the case that the gentleman at the FBI was the person who reassured the White House, and the story had been a New York Times and CNN story saying there were lots of contacts between Trump campaign officials and the Russians. CNN took it further and said they were constant contacts, and apparently he said that wasn't true, and they tried to get him to go public with that. I think that this is something where there's a great deal of severity, and the underlying thing to me is whatever reassurances are given by the current acting head of the FBI, he's not going to be the head of the FBI going forward, and it can be very damaging to an investigation, to an institution, and we see, in effect, a kind of a long-term purge of this that's just deeply distressing in so many obvious ways.
All right. Maybe it's a coincidence, maybe it's not, but under cover of the media obsessing on the firing of James Comey, Trump announces a commission to study voter fraud, and Sessions announces that he'll start seeking the maximum sentence for nonviolent drug offenders. These topics are both ongoing concerns of the Brennan Center for Justice. What do you make of the voter fraud commission?
So you're right, and sometimes every time there's a Russia story, Trump screams voter fraud, not necessarily to bring a distraction. As folks remember, during the campaign, Trump started to say that the election was rigged, that there was going to be massive voter fraud. And then even after the election, he said that he'd really won the popular vote. When you subtract the 3 to 5 million illegal voters, non-citizens especially, who he insisted were voting, and mathematically, I guess they must have all voted for Hillary Clinton, you know, invisibly. This was kind of taken as one of his early big lies. But in a sense, it's the cartoon version of the argument that's always made as to why you need restrictive voting laws, that somehow there's massive voter fraud, which has been proven over and over again not to be the case. Well, Trump said a few months ago, we're going to investigate it. I'm going to ask Mike Pence to do it. People thought perhaps they had dropped the idea, but yesterday they announced this commission. It's in the past, these commissions have been bipartisan. You had Jimmy Carter and James Baker. This is chaired by Mike Pence, the vice president, and the vice chair is a guy named Chris Kobach, who is the Secretary of State of Kansas and probably the most aggressive official in the country at making dubious allegations of voter fraud and trying to pass voting restrictive laws. So it doesn't look like a very balanced commission.
This is a name that people should know and a voice that people should know going forward on this. So here is Kansas Secretary of State Chris Kobach on the PBS NewsHour in March of 2014 on the issue of our vulnerability to voter fraud.
In most of the states in the union, you simply just fill out the registration card, check a box saying I'm a U.S. citizen, sign it, and you're done. But four states, including Kansas and Arizona, have said no, proof of citizenship, documentary proof is necessary because so many aliens are on our voter rolls. We've found them in our two states, and most often they're manipulated by someone who says, hey, you can vote, and they're trying to generate votes for a particular local candidate in some cases, and they don't even know they're breaking the law.
He says they found them in their two states, in those two states. But Slate reports what he found was just 9 cases of alleged fraud out of 1.8 million registered Kansas voters.
Right. Chris Kobach is like somebody who bedevils a fire department by constantly pulling the fire alarm, and then they show up, and then it turns out it wasn't even a smoky toaster. He claims these crises, and then they don't pan out. In this last election, the Brennan Center recently did a study where we actually asked the local officials who would know whether or not there's actually non-citizens voting. And in states and jurisdictions that added up to about 29 million voters, they reported maybe 30 people. And sure, it happens occasionally, but far from this massive problem. And every study has shown that. And again, Kobach's activities have very often been struck down by courts precisely because there's very little basis for them.
Huh. An early version of the report on the creation of this commission, which I mentioned on yesterday's show because it came over during yesterday's show and I mentioned it in real time, that version said this commission will study voter fraud and voter suppression. But I have since read the actual executive order, and there's nothing in there about studying voter suppression as a problem. Am I missing something?
No, you're exactly right. Between the leaks and the photocopiers, that fell out of the order. I looked at the briefing by the White House, and it said the same thing. That this is an effort, this is a some people have called it a voter suppression task force. It's a bunch of people, most of whom have longstanding records of being kind of Inspector Clouseau searching for voter fraud somewhere and using it as an excuse for passing laws that make it harder for eligible people to vote. And so there's no reason to think that it will be anything resembling a balanced or useful panel. And it's too bad because there really are problems with the voting systems that can be fixed.
Maybe this commission is a good thing. If they investigate voter fraud and find not much, because there's not much to find, then that'll give Trump one less thing to make stuff up about.
If they actually do an honest investigation and if they actually find very little and if they characterize it that way, I guess that would be a good thing, but I'm not exactly holding my breath that that'll be the case. You know, this is one of those areas where one example can get blown up into an epidemic by people who are trying to push a policy. And, you know, we all know that these laws fall hardest on poor people, communities of color, older people. There's a deep political purpose behind them, and so I don't credit this group with a lot of good intentions. I don't expect, unfortunately, to be proven wrong on this one.
Michael Waldman from the Brennan Center for Justice, Rosie Gray from The Atlantic. Rosie, I don't know if you've been reporting on this commission at all so far, but any thoughts on how this dovetails with the other politics of the moment? Was it a coincidence that this was released into the teeth of the coverage of the Comey firing this week, or any other observation?
You know, I don't really buy into to the theory that Trump does things to sort of distract from other things. I think, you know, this is an Occam's razor situation with this presidency where it really is just chaotic. So I don't necessarily believe that they sort of, you know, did this to that one thing was supposed to distract something else or anything like that. I mean, Donald Trump has been talking about alleged voter fraud for a long time. I mean, despite the fact that he won the presidency, he seems to be hung up on this idea that there were millions of illegal votes. And, you know, this is, you know, a classic example of them trying to sort of like retroactively find justifications for things that he said and claims that he's made.
Kath, go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, it's a commission with taxpayer money being spent that flows directly from an overheated late-night tweet. You know, and imagine the idea that there are millions of people voting not 100 years ago or 50 years ago, but 6 months ago that nobody noticed. They were so invisible that nobody saw them. Fox News didn't see them. But now we need a commission to investigate it. I think this flows directly from his anxieties through his Twitter fingers.
Kathleen on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Kathleen.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. There's one aspect, one motivation that I haven't heard any comment on. Maybe there has been.
You mean for firing Comey?
For firing Comey. I think that Trump obviously felt that he was being upstaged. He said a couple of months ago to Comey, "You're more famous than I am," or "You're getting more famous than I am."
On inauguration
day. And he called him
a
grandstander. I think that part of it was that he felt that Comey was casting him in the shade and getting too much attention.
I'm glad you brought that up. It makes me think way back to when Giuliani fired William Bratton, who was doing a great job as police commissioner by most accounts, but he was upstaging Rudy Giuliani. He was on, you know, the cover of the magazines and stuff like that, and Giuliani couldn't abide by that, and he fired him. And Trump did say in his NBC interview yesterday, he's a grandstander and a showboater, Rosie. I mean, you know, to say the obvious, Trump is a grandstander and a showboater, a serial grandstander and showboater his whole life. But it Well, what do you make of him saying that out loud about James Comey?
Well, I mean, I think that I would make two points on this. One is that this is something that we've seen before with Donald Trump, where he can't really bear to have someone else sort of, you know, upstage him or be in the limelight instead of him. And the other point I would make is that, you know, they're saying that he was showboating, that he was grandstanding, as making it sound as though he was doing like constant TV hits, Comey, or something like that. Well, he was like appearing at congressional hearings and stuff to which he'd been invited to testify. So, you know, that's also a point on which, you know, it's sort of like an odd thing to say.
Though, in fairness, the Democrats certainly thought he was grandstanding when last July he didn't just let the Hillary Clinton email investigation go without an indictment when he decided no indictment was appropriate. He grandstanded by then giving his critique of how irresponsible Clinton was. And, of course, that was seen as grandstanding, Michael, by the Democrats.
Yeah, and look, I mean, this may be one of – Trump is very good with these epithets. This may be his version of low energy or, you know, something like that.
Little Marco. Little Marco.
There was plenty to critique about Comey and including the grandstanding that he did, but that's not why he was fired. I mean, I think the notion of Occam's razor is a very good one in this example, you know, which is the shortest distance between two lines points is a straight line. The simplest explanation often is actually what's right. I remember during Watergate, you know, everyone spent about a year and a half wondering what was driving Nixon, and was it because why was he behaving so self-destructively, and was it because his father was mean to him? Was he like Richard III in Shakespeare? And the answer was he was guilty, and he was covering up because he'd committed a crime, and he was logically, if brutally, trying to cover it up. And I just think the other thing Trump said when he said, well, the Russian investigation, in my view, is a fake, so I fired him. It's actually much simpler than some of the kind of psychological explanations we might have.
Well, some people in the media in the last day have been saying that the difference is that in Watergate, we knew there was a crime. There was the Watergate break-in. In this case, we don't know if there's collusion. So the mystery is a little bit deeper. But I would add to that that we do know that there was a crime. There was the crime of Russia hacking our election. And there's the question of whether Trump or anybody from his campaign colluded to aid a foreign hostile country in hacking our democracy. And there are all these wisps of suggestions that maybe they did, because all these Trump people keep covering up the fact that they had contacts with Russia at that time or just after the election. But they still haven't answered the question as to whether there's a crime on the part of any Trump people that has to do with collusion to cover up.
And that's one of the reasons that folks think that not only a special prosecutor, which I didn't think it was necessary up until this moment, but I do think something needs to be done to guarantee the independence of the investigation. A special prosecutor would only look at whether there's a violation of the U.S. criminal code. But this was a political outrage. This was, as you say, the subversion of our democracy by a hostile foreign government. And if not criminal collusion, certainly very problematic connections. And so there's a need, therefore, for Congress to do its job, which is broader, for investigations, maybe a special commission, but certainly just checks and balances. These congressional committees should stand up and do their job and not merely put party over country.
I do want to get to what Jeff Sessions did this morning, which may be the most important thing that happened all week and may get buried in the weekend news cycle. He says he's going to reverse Obama-era policy and return to seeking the maximum sentence for nonviolent drug offenders. How significant is that?
It is very significant, and it is part of a much an even larger turn in policy that Jeff Sessions is a key player in. You know, we're used at this point to seeing the Trump White House and administration as this kind of combination of slapstick and incompetence and potential abuse of power. Jeff Sessions is very competent. He's just on these issues, in my view, and in many people's view, very backwards. He was the single most aggressive member of Congress out of 100 senators in resisting criminal justice reform last year. This is something where there is a bipartisan consensus to do something about mass incarceration. Eric Holder, as Attorney General, took a number of steps within his power to try to reform the way prosecutions are done, the way the Justice Department works, so it's not driving mass incarceration, sending people to prison. What Sessions did today was to reverse a big part of what's called the Smart on Crime initiative that Holder did. And what Holder had said to prosecutors is you don't have to always go for the highest charge you can. You can go for a lower charge if that makes sense. And what this says is, no, you do have to go for the highest charge. If you want to go around that, you need the approval of your supervisor. You need to write your rationale in writing. It really puts a very strong pressure on the prosecutors, the line prosecutors, to throw the book at every defendant. And that's heading in the wrong direction. Many of these crimes are crimes where, yeah, there ought to be punishment, but not the maximum. And that's one of the reasons that we have, you know, as has often been said, 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prison population.
Rosie Gray from The Atlantic, any early reaction to this? This just happened a short time before we went on the air. But as a political reporter, how do you see the politics of Jeff Sessions announcing this at all or announcing this at this time? I mean, Trump campaigned to black Americans on what have you got to lose. We know that mass incarceration of nonviolent drug offenders is a racial disparity issue.
Right. I mean, look, like in terms of the sort of, like you were saying, I mean, you know, the news cycle is so consumed by the Jim Comey story at this point that, you know, it's not clear to me yet exactly what the kind of like political fallout or political reaction is going to be. You know, I would note that, you know, there had within the Republican Party, there had been these sort of gestures towards wanting to do criminal justice reform. Mike Lee and others had been talking about this and trying to do things on this. And obviously this is, you know, this is a Republican administration sort of going in the exact opposite direction. So it'll be interesting to see, like, what sort of the impact could be, whether there'll be an interesting sort of reaction on the Hill and in other places.
So to end this part of the conversation on a little bit of the absurd to add to the profoundly serious, going around Twitter right now in the last few minutes, Melissa McCarthy has been spotted in full Spicer regalia with the podium. She's going to be hosting Saturday Night Live tomorrow night, Rosie, as you probably know, and she's probably most famous for her Sean Spicer impression. It could be she'll have to do both Spicer and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the other White House spokesman who's been kind of sitting in for Spicer this week and has been even more spicy than Spicer, I would say, with the way she's been glowering and sneering at the members of the press corps.
Well, I'm very excited to see what Melissa McCarthy has come up with this weekend.
And so we will. And we thank Rosie Gray from The Atlantic, Michael Waldman from the Brennan Center for Justice. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And we'll continue with Fred Kaplan from Slate in a minute.